Hi, all, and welcome to Food. I'm Kate Bittman, and if I've counted correctly, this is the 100th episode of season 3 of this podcast. So an extra thanks to you for being here. Remember, you can always email us at food@markbittman.com, and that you can find us online at bittmanproject.com. Last week featured notably Mark and Kathleen's travels through Japan, where they did a ton, but my favorite part, I think, was their exploration of lunch at a school on the island of Kyushu where everything is made from scratch. Dashi, chopped vegetables, chicken, rice, fish. It sounds fantastic, and the pictures are just so joyful. Also, Ed Schneider makes the case for beans with pasta, and of course, don't forget to check out Von Diaz's recipe for keshiyana. Stuffed cheese, yes please, bittmanproject.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Did you know that for every $1 the USDA flashes in front of farmers to encourage them to grow to the max, it dangles just 13 cents to help them conserve the land? I didn't, but I'm not surprised. A recent article in Mother Jones called Farmers Could Be the Nation's Leading Environmentalists explores what would happen if the approach was reversed and conservation was a prerequisite for farmers to receive subsidies. Tom Philpott, today's guest on Food, wrote this article. A professional journalist for more than 20 years, including a decade-long stint as the food and agriculture correspondent for Mother Jones, Tom is now a senior research associate at the Center for a Livable Future at Johns Hopkins University. Mark has known and followed Tom for years and has consistently used his work, Tom's work, that is, as a source for detailed writing about farms and farm policy, which Tom has been super knowledgeable about for a long time. And when we saw his current piece, we'd wondered why it took us so long to ask him to come on the podcast. Before we start today's interview with Tom Philpott, we've got a sort of amuse-bouche for you. We've got a couple reader questions in our inbox that tended towards food styling, so we thought it'd be fun to source more of those and get our friend, an extremely talented food stylist, he worked on Mark's upcoming book, more on that soon, Barrett Washburn, on to answer those. I ended up asking Barrett a ton of questions, all reader-sourced, so we're going to break those up and answer a couple today and a couple on each episode moving forward, till we're done. It's been a lot of fun, and I think, hope, you'll feel that way too. So here I am with food stylist extraordinaire Barrett Washburn. Today's topics are how he got into food styling and how he feels about it, why pots and pans always look so clean on television, and how to get your pots and pans really clean. Barrett, you're an artist by trade, which makes total sense when it comes to your mastery of food styling. The day you decided to go into food styling, you were working at a gallery and you hated it. And one day you went to work, quit, and turned right back around to go home. What came next?
I think French culinary had like a 2 or 3 day course on food styling. So I took that and I was like, this is cool. I want to do it. So I started looking around, like, what do I need to do? So I decided to go to culinary school. So I went to ICE for a year, and then I did an externship at Good Housekeeping in Hearst Tower. And Susan Westmoreland was the director of food there at the time. She's just a wonderful human. And she was like, I'll take you on all the food shoots and like introduce you to food stylists. So she did. And then they actually offered me a job at Good Housekeeping, but I was like, no, I don't want to get stuck in something I don't want to do again. So I just started assisting. And yeah, that was, yeah, like 11, 12 years ago, maybe. So I assisted for 2 years. And then it was almost like everybody got together and they were like, you're done, go. And I was like, well, how do I get jobs? What do I do? But eventually, you know, it started coming, and now I'm really, really busy.
This totally answers the person's question about how you break into the business if you haven't had experience before. But you went to art school, so you really are an artist. It's what I said. Like, I realized that I would be a terrible food stylist because I have no art experience. I feel like it is such a craft.
There is definitely like an inherent thing that I cannot teach people. People can assist me, I can show you what I do, but there's just an innate sense of composition and color that, I don't know, I was always artistic as a child. Like, that's all I wanted to be, was an artist, a sculptor. Three dimensions was always my thing. I used to love to like weld, work in the wood shop, clay, all that stuff. But, you know, I don't have a trust fund, so I had to learn how to make money for myself. I'm so glad I found this, because I've honestly never been happier in a job in my life. I honestly thought that all the people that said they loved their jobs were just lying, because they were just trying to make themselves feel better about it. And I did not think that loving your job was a thing, but I am excited to go to work every day. And it's a nice job because I'm around really cool, creative people.
Okay, so the reason that we're talking is because, well, I'm a fan, but also we got a reader question about food styling, and I thought it would be interesting to talk more about it because it's pretty fascinating to a lot of people. So the first question is, why does every pot and pan and every filmed episode of every cooking show sparkle and shine as though they're being used for the first time? I've tried Thomas Keller's technique of scouring with salt and oil, and I've tried the baking soda paste method, but my cookware just looks used. What is the secret?
It's probably because they are, in fact, brand new. Usually when you're doing a show, like, we get a lot of like trade outs, like people will send product, like pans, for you to use on the show just so that they have their product featured. So most times they are actually brand new. In some cases, they have been super scoured. Barkeeper's Friend works really well to get pots clean. You can let it sit for a while and make a little paste. Also, if it's really, really, really bad, I've used oven cleaner. You can spray on like Easy Off and let it sit. And then it's toxic as hell, but it works. But most of the time, they're new. They're brand new.
I love that. I'm sure it's going to make a lot of people feel better. But I personally like having my cookware look used because it makes me feel like I've done good work.
Like you actually cooked. Yeah, mm-hmm.
I agree. Yeah, I think that's sort of why people love...
None of mine looks new at home.
No, God, no. I think that's sort of why people... One of the reasons people love Le Creuset so much. Hope you enjoyed that little Q&A with Barrett. We'll have more with him next week. And now here's Tom Philpott and Mark.
Hi, Tom. Welcome. Thanks for joining me on Food with Mark Bittman.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
We've known each other a while, and I know that we know different things, and we have worked on the same things also. But your depth of knowledge on policy and on existing federal farm policy has always impressed me, and you wrote this piece for Mother Jones just a couple of weeks ago about farmers and conservation and the farm bill. And I want to talk about that, but I think people are curious about subsidies in general, the farm bill in general. I never feel adequate in explaining that stuff to people. So maybe we could unpack a sort of bigger picture, but also talk about, you know, the headline of your piece is farmers could be the nation's leading environmentalists. People don't often associate farming and conservation. So maybe we start with that, but try to get to a little bit of a bigger picture.
Yeah. So if you think about how the Farm Bill started, it starts in the 1930s when you've got this situation of the paradox of incredible overabundance. Farmers were producing too much food. Prices were dropping, were really low. They were losing their shirts. There were, mass bankruptcies happening in farm country. At the same time, there's hunger. It's the Great Depression. People can't afford food, even though that it's so cheap. And then you also have this dust bowl happening, this environmental catastrophe happening in the Great Plains area. And so it's like this sort of poly crisis, very similar to the multiple crises we have going on right now. So the idea of the Farm Bill was to fix those three things in one swoop, to, put programs in place to help farmers conserve soil. And we get this, sort of soil health programs started at that time. And then you get supply management. And the idea of supply management is to help coordinate farmers because, basically what farmers do, if I'm a wheat farmer or a corn farmer and the price drops, instead of saying, okay, I'm going to plant, less corn or wheat, what I do is I plant more hoping to make up on volume when I'm losing on price.
Right.
Then everyone does the same thing. And then you get these cycles of overproduction. And that this had been happening in agriculture for a while. It culminates in the 20s with this giant overproduction and drop in prices. And so the Farm Bill was going to fix all three of those things. And so that was the idea.
Wait, so it's trying to fix overproduction, low prices.
Yeah.
And environmental disaster.
And make sure that people can afford food. And so the idea of supply management was that you would sort of produce enough food where prices are within reach of consumers, but help farmers not overproduce to where they drop. And, also food aid programs, came into play too, to make sure that poor people had enough to eat.
It's probably worth saying that race to the bottom, that sort of like produce more while prices drop, was one of the factors that started to drive small farmers out of existence in the 20s and 30s.
Absolutely. And so what happens with supply management that I think often gets lost in these wonky Farm Bill conversations is that the USDA is really doing two things at once in the post-war era. So like starting in the late 40s into the first couple of decades of the post-war era. On the one hand, they're running the supply management program. How they do that is acreage quotas. You can only plant so many acres of corn this year. You get a notice from the USDA office how many acres of corn you can plant. The idea was to keep corn from getting oversupplied. And so the USDA is doing that. But at the same time, other parts of the USDA are really pushing industrial agriculture. They're giving lots and lots of low interest loans so farmers can scale up and buy tractors. So they can buy these, hybrid seeds that are coming out and get hybrid seeds needed fertilizers and pesticides. They're loaning farmers money to do all that stuff and really encouraging it with the extension service, the agents that are out in the field helping farmers, take care of technological problems. And so what that does simultaneously with supply management is it causes productivity to skyrocket. So every acre of corn is producing way more corn than it used to with, fertilizers and pesticides and giant tractors. And so despite supply management, what you get is throughout this post-war period, you get this drop in crop prices. You get, farm bankruptcies. If you look at the number of U.S. farms, like a long chart, the number of U.S. farms since 1900, what you see is basically this steady decline in the post-war era. Despite supply management, crop yields are rising so fast prices are dropping and farmers are going out of business on a grand scale. And you get this, you know, despite supply management, this race to the bottom. And so you get that, you know, basically supply management failed because it couldn't keep up with these productivity gains. And so you get to the 1970s and, you know, what the USDA decides in 1970s is under Earl Butz.
We should point out for those who don't remember that Earl Butz was Richard Nixon's Secretary of Agriculture.
Yeah. And a very, you know, colorful character. Very plain spoken fellow. Actually ended up getting fired for one of the most off color jokes that I've ever heard.
I have to try to remember that.
But everyone let's should not Google, go there. everyone should Google what he, you know, why he ended up getting fired. But Earl Butz, he decides, let's make this bargain. Let's stop worrying about overproduction. Let's produce all out. Let's produce as much corn as we want, soybeans and wheat. Let's take away the acreage quotas. And what we'll do is we'll export the surplus. We'll find markets to sop up this surplus. Everyone will make lots of money.
So we go from supply management to Earl Butz's famous quote, fence post to fence post. In other words, dig up your driveway and plant corn in your driveway. We go from supply management to let's produce as much as we possibly can.
Yeah. And when your neighbor goes out of business and you buy his land, raise his farmhouse and plant corn and soybeans there. But basically, this bargain ends up not working out. The U.S. productivity is we produce so much that export markets can't sop it up. We get a farm crisis in the 80s. We get, you know, once again, plunging prices. And so we get this shift to, instead of supply management, to keep the biggest farmers in business, we shift from supply management to subsidies. And that's where we get where we are today, where we're pouring all this money into subsidies. And we're telling farmers, hey, if the price drops, don't worry about it. You'll get subsidized crop insurance, it'll pay the difference. You'll get payments that pay the difference. And we'll keep you in the business of farming. And so what you get now is a situation where farmers get, you know, I think it's in my piece, you know, in recent decades, about $16 billion a year on average in subsidies. And then you get another erosion crisis based on this Earl Butz frenzy of the 70s. You get massive soil erosion throughout the Corn Belt. And so in the 1985 Farm Bill, for the first time, we get conservation programs come into play. And the idea is that we're not going to regulate farmers. We're not going to say, we're not going to tell farmers how to farm. We're not going to say you can't farm in a way that's making your soil go away, but we're going to pay you to do these certain practices. And so you get conservation funds. And what I point out in my piece is that for the past, I think since the early 2000s, for every dollar we've spent paying farmers, essentially paying them to farm all out, we're paying them about 13 cents to, you know, around the margins, do some conservation practices. So it's, you know, this huge imbalance in incentives. And as a result, we're having yet another erosion crisis.
What's the idea? The number you use is $14 billion, by the way, in subsidies to farm all out, as you say. What's the idea of that, of those subsidies? I mean, what's the, there must have been some principle that said this is a good thing. It wasn't just we're going to give people a bunch of money, or maybe it was, but what is the idea behind that?
I think it was expedience. I think it was, okay, well, supply management failed. Because of this massive boom in crop yields that happened in the second half of the 20th century. So we can't do that anymore. This export idea of Earl Butz's failed because the export markets, you know, we export a whole lot of food, but it's not nearly enough to take care of this oversupply. And so we have to do something for farmers. And the subsidies, the way they're structured, you kind of, on a per acre basis, even though we're averaging $14 billion a year, like you say, on a per acre basis, it's not very much money. So you have to have a whole lot of land, thousands of acres to make it make economic sense. And so I would say that it's life support for those largest farmers to ensure that they stay in business. Because if they start going out of business, then, you know, then what? Then, you know, we got no one farming at all. So it's like the minimum amount to keep those few remaining farmers in the Corn Belt fat and happy. And there's been no justification for it. No one's come out and said, this is a great system. It's always like, oh, we're doing this, but you know, the next idea is going to work. And Mark, another, you know, big idea. So we had supply management, we had exports, and in the 2000s, we got ethanol. So let's do a big ethanol program. And the ethanol program is now sopping up a third of the corn crop. And it's still not enough to stop this oversupply problem. So ethanol was the third thing. And you'll hear Tom Vilsack, the Secretary of Ag under Biden, go around talking about the ethanol program as this way to keep farmers in the land. But it's, you know, it's basically, it isn't sufficient. It's not knocking out the need for subsidies, basically.
Right. And it's worth pointing out, I suppose, that all that land that's being used to grow corn for ethanol is not being used to grow actual food.
No.
And that ethanol is not particularly a useful form of energy. So there's that too.
Oh, it's terrible.
I'm going to point out, because this is all such a complex and weird web of stuff, and just so that we mention it, I'm going to point out that this whole period of overproduction of mostly corn and soybeans, other stuff too, but mostly corn and soybeans, led to encouraged the growth of industrial production of animals, because
no doubt
you were training animals to eat foods, especially grazing animals, like cows. You were training them to eat food that they weren't born to eat, since grazing animals are supposed to eat grass. That's the same word, graze and grass. But because there was so much corn and soybeans, it was like, well, let's feed these to animals. And it sort of worked as long as antibiotics were involved. And so now we produce, I don't know, 1 billion chickens a year and 200 million pigs and some huge number of cattle as well. And all of that is dependent on this overproduction of corn and soybeans.
Exactly. That model would collapse tomorrow if you didn't have rock bottom corn and soybean prices. And in fact, in times in the past 20 years, and we've seen corn and soybean prices rise because of ethanol there for a while, because of the war in Ukraine there for a hot minute, you've seen, you know, severe profit strains on these companies. But then the price always goes, I mean, on the meat companies, because they're having to pay more for their feed, but the price always goes back down again and the profitability restores. The business model needs lots and lots of cheap corn and soybeans.
Yeah. I mean, the junk food business model needs that also, as long as we're talking about outcomes of this. Okay, so we have this situation where there are these subsidies to mostly big farmers. Well, there are only big farmers left at this point, to a large extent. It's in turn being propped up by the ethanol industry, by the industrial production of animal, factory farming industry, the junk food industry, and so on and so on and so on. That sort of brings us to the current day. And we haven't seen a significant, really significant changes in these subsidies and in the farm bill, which is supposedly up for reauthorization every 5 years, but it always seems to happen every 6 or 7 years because they can't get around to it. But we haven't seen a big change in that stuff in many years.
No.
I mean, they tinker at the margins.
Exactly.
And there are reasons for that, but probably that's beyond the scope of this conversation.
We're in a period of stasis. I mean, except, you know, I would say the one exception to that is that this, you know, to get a little bit more wonky just for a second, at a certain point, I think in the 80s, or 70s, they crammed together food aid in the form of food stamps and farm programs. And the idea was that urban legislators would vote for food aid and make sure it didn't get cut. And farm state legislators would vote for farm aid and make sure it wouldn't get cut. And if you crammed it together, they would have a coalition, and you'd get a farm bill every year that had a robust SNAP program and robust farm programs. This sort of Tea Party / Freedom Caucus era that we're in with the Republican, I mean, mainly in the House, but it's also in the Senate, has basically ripped that old coalition to shreds. And I think that's why the past couple of farm bills, including this one, have gotten delayed, because these guys, some of them want to cut both farm subsidies and food aid, but they all want to cut food aid. So there's all, every farm bill, there's this huge fight to preserve SNAP, which is the food aid program. And so that puts farm aid, you know, that puts people who want a different kind of farm aid, a more progressive kind of farm aid, on their back heel because they're fighting to defend SNAP. And that's kind of where we are now. These guys want to put work requirements on it, and they want to lessen the level of aid. And Mark, I know you know this, that the level of aid is barely sufficient now. We should probably be strengthening SNAP. And so there's this, you know, constant need to fight for SNAP. And that's exactly what sank the farm bill in 2023. And, you know, who knows what's going to happen this year, but it's going to be a fight.
Right. I mean, there is the thing that I said is probably beyond the scope of this conversation is not any longer, but there is this sort of odd, you know, politics make strange bedfellows moment where we, that is Democrats and people, progressive people on the left in general, want to preserve and strengthen food stamps. And they, that is Republicans, want to make sure that those subsidies remain in place. And that's sort of been the grand compromise of the past, I don't know, 20 or 30 years even, really, right?
Yeah.
Stay tuned for more from Tom Philpott and Mark.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Have you ever bought something, owned something that really inspired you to up your game? A tennis racket, a new pair of running shoes, a new piece of cooking equipment that made you just want to cook your brains out? I know that when I first started cooking on induction burners, I just couldn't stop. It was so much fun. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Some of the features that are available on this car include Dynamic Sky Panorama Glass Roof, Front Row Massaging Seats, you know you want that. Available 33-inch all-terrain tires, which you will want when you check out the multi-terrain select. These are really great features, the kind of features that will make you proud and happy to own a Lexus GX. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer. Hi, folks. We have a new sponsor and an interesting one. We all take about 20,000 breaths a day, and Americans spend about 90% of our time indoors. That indoor air that we breathe can be up to 100 times more polluted than outdoor air, according to the EPA. And indoor air pollutants can cause respiratory symptoms like sneezing, congestion, scratchy throat, and even more serious health problems like lung and heart disease. So, what's the solution? Introducing Air Doctor, the air purifier that filters out 99.99% of dangerous contaminants so your lungs don't have to. This includes allergens, pollen, pet dander, dust mites, mold spores, and even bacteria and viruses. Air Doctor comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund. Head to airdoctorpro.com and use promo code BITMAN, B-I-T-T-M-A-N, and you'll receive up to $300 off air purifiers. Exclusive to our listeners, you will also receive a free 3-year warranty on any unit, which is an additional $84 value. Lock in this special offer by going to airdoctorpro.com. That's airdoctorpro.com and use the promo code BITMAN. Let's talk about what your piece was about and your proposal that it would be a simple switch to take some of that subsidy money and turn farmers into environmentalists or conservationists.
Yeah, so I got this idea from this woman at University of Iowa named Sylvia Secchi, who's a just great thinker on these topics. And she's, you know, operating right there in the middle of the Corn Belt in, you know, in the middle of Iowa. And her idea is just really simple. So we talked about the imbalance there. We have $14 billion for farmers every year on average to produce all out, and a little bit less than $2 billion in these conservation programs. And, you know, we should say as a caveat, these conservation programs, they have been compromised by these big ag interests. A lot of them do go into subsidizing farmers to put in stuff like manure pits for their giant, you know, hog operations. But it's still an important concept. And so her idea is, instead of this contradictory policy where it's so much imbalance, what her proposal is you tell farmers that, okay, if you want the goodies, if you want, you know, subsidized crop insurance and literal payments into your bank account to farm corn and soybeans, then you have to show the USDA your plan to conserve soil, your plan to keep water clean. And why this is important, Mark, there's this team of researchers at University of Massachusetts that have been putting out these jaw-dropping studies in peer-reviewed journals showing that soil erosion in the Corn Belt is happening at about somewhere between 100 and 1,000 times the rate of natural replenishment. So we're hemorrhaged. And I tease this out of my book, Perilous Bounty, that came out 2020. But since that book, my book came out, this team of researchers led by this guy, Isaac Larson, has been putting out these reports that are just stunning. So we're in this erosion crisis.
Inches per year. Yeah.
Yeah.
Of topsoil.
I mean, it's just incredible. And, you know, what they show is that on a third of the ground in the Corn Belt, this layer of rich topsoil that is so famous and so celebrated that American farmers encountered when we sort of took over the Corn Belt and kicked out the Native Americans, on a third of the Corn Belt, it's completely eroded away, and you're looking at subsoil that you can grow food on. If you pound it with fertilizers and stuff, you can grow food on it, but it is, you know, it's not a good situation. And so what Sylvia is, what she's saying is, okay, if you want this money, it's here for you. We'll, you know, cut you a check. We'll give you this subsidized crop insurance, but you've got to show us your plan for conserving soil and not polluting water. Water pollution is just absolutely just prolific throughout the Corn Belt. And so you wouldn't be telling anyone how to farm. There wouldn't be any regulation, but you would have to show a plan. And the things that accomplish these goals of stopping erosion and cleaning water are crop diversification, not just growing corn and soybeans, but adding a third or a fourth crop. Stuff like agroforestry, planting rows of trees, which is, there are actually people doing it in the Corn Belt. It's very effective. You could, you know, simply plant, you know, do, if you're in the right area, do cover crops, you know, keep the ground covered in the off season with cover crops. You could return animals to the land. You could take, you know, stop putting animals in these giant operations and, you know, graze cows and do pastured hogs. You could like take a third of your land every year and plant it in feed crops and send, you know, animals out. And, you know, so there's all kinds of, it would actually unleash innovation. It would take us out of this stagnation, this long period of stagnation and reliance on corn and soybeans, and potentially unleash real innovation in farm country while also preserving soil. And I think, you know, Mark, both you and I are both, how we got into this work on food politics is because we love food. We love to eat. Imagine the interesting foods that could come out of the Corn Belt besides inedible corn and soybeans.
Yeah.
That literally you have to be a hog or a cow to eat. You know, just imagine the sort of cornucopia that could happen. And so that's the vision, is basically you tell farmers, if you want the goodies, then show us how you're going to stop sacrificing your soil and polluting water for everyone.
So you're not even really, or she's not even really talking about changing the way the subsidies work. She's just saying, okay, we give up. We're going to let these subsidies stay in place. But in exchange, you got to give us something besides inedible food.
Exactly. And one of the things that I think is so subversive and smart about it is that these farmers in the Corn Belt, the way their ideology has sort of developed over the decades is that they basically see these farm subsidies as birthright. Like it's sort of a, you know, government off my Medicare kind of situation.
Yeah, exactly.
But they see regulation, and the Farm Bureau, this giant lobbying force, has a lot to do with this. They also see regulation as absolutely intolerable. It's government jackboots telling me what to do with my land.
Right. The subsidies are unfettered, and that's how they should be, right?
Yeah. And but at the same time, don't regulate me. And great rhetorical sort of flourish here, because what you're saying is, we're not regulating you, we're not taking away your subsidies. But if you want them, then you have to do these things. And if you don't want them, continue farming as you are. And we got nothing to say to you, but you're not getting these goodies.
I want to unpack a couple things, because when it's you and me talking, we can take some stuff for granted. But each of the things you said in the last 5 minutes, or many of the things you said in the last 5 minutes about these proposals, are interesting in their own right. These are not radical ideas. These are like pretty freaking simple, basic stuff. We are not talking about dismantling industrial farming when we're talking about cover crops, rotating, lower till. I mean, we've both looked at the difference between that dead soil sort of substrata when all the topsoil is gone and what healthy soil looks like. And it really visually and texturally, it's super striking. It's the difference between black, rich, bug and worm and substance-laden, beautiful stuff and this kind of gray, lifeless, weird shit that you need fertilizer. You need to, as you say, pump in the fertilizer to grow anything. And we know you can grow crops in artificial soil with enough chemicals, but that's hardly the goal.
I think there are two things to look at, you know, and they're both really simple. If you grow the same two things every year, corn and soybeans, you plant them at the same time in the spring, kind of like May-ish, and you harvest them at the same time, November, October, November, that period. We're talking about basically the combined corn and soybean acres are 1.7 times the size of California. So this is a huge amount of land devoted to these two crops.
That's an unbelievable statistic.
I know. And so if you plant the same two crops and you harvest them at the same time, what happens is between harvest and then not just planting, but until the canopy comes up, until you get a canopy of green plant matter, in the summer, In the in-between time, you have bare soil. And when you have bare soil and you get really hard rains hitting it, it sends soil on the move. There's nothing to hold it in. There's no living roots. There's nothing protecting it. And so you get these massive erosion events. And because of climate change, we know that we're going to get fiercer. We've already seen it. It's already happening, but it's going to continue happening. Fiercer spring storms are going to come in and hit this bare ground and send soil on the move. And then not just soil, now we get to the water problem, but all the chemicals that are in that soil, the nitrogen fertilizer, the pesticides, the herbicides, all of those go on the move too, and they get into people's water and cause all kinds of problems. Algae blooms, nitrate pollution. Nitrate is emerging as a carcinogen. The science around, you know, low levels of nitrate in water as a carcinogen is getting really stark. And then the other thing is, so that's, you know, one aspect. The other aspect is plowing. Just when you plow every year, you're just breaking up microbial patterns. You're, you know, reducing the sort of integrity of the soil. And that also causes massive erosion. So we need coverage as much as possible year round, and we need to plow as little as possible. And if you don't do those things, then, you know, you're basically losing soil at this, you know, tremendous rate. The USDA has made a big push for cover crops, and you hear all about, you know, from the Farm Bureau about how cover crops are growing at this dramatic rate. They still cover way less than 10% of ground in the Corn Belt in the winter right now.
Right. And even with cover crops, you're not talking about the problem you were just talking about, which is post-planting in spring and early summer, when the cover crops have been turned in or dug up and the so-called real crops have been planted and they're not growing yet. So the soil's exposed to wind and rain. It would be a radical and maybe even foolhardy notion to suggest that these subsidies be stopped immediately. I mean, we could play with that idea, but let's take a more realistic approach and say, what if, say, there are $14 billion worth of subsidies propping up the corn and soybean industry? Suppose 20%, say, of those subsidies were reallocated to good causes. What might it look like if we took $3 or $4 billion and put it into regenerative agriculture?
I mean, I think that would be a great start. And I think that I think the potential would be that, you know, it's not hard to find examples of farmers doing regenerative agriculture in the Corn Belt. They remain pretty few and far between. And if you develop more of them and you show that it was successful, you know, it could start more, it could sort of jumpstart and speed up the process of, you know, people looking at their neighbor and saying, wow, this person over here is paying a fraction of what I pay for chemicals and their yields are just as high and their farm is more vibrant. Maybe I should try what they're doing. I think it would help jumpstart that. And I think that would be a very positive thing in the interim. It's way better than nothing. I guess my big takeaway is that this current farm bill that's in Congress right now, I don't have very high hopes for it. I think it's got a lot of political obstacles. But the next farm bill, and people have been saying this forever, it's always the next farm bill.
We always, even I've been saying that for 20 years.
Yeah. But for the first time in that period, Mark, we have people in Congress like Cory Booker, who's got an incredible, he's on the Ag Committee. He's got incredibly progressive positions. I don't remember having someone
he's the man.
Actually understood this stuff in the Senate. You've got Ro Khanna. You've got this guy, Greg Kassar from Austin, my hometown and former place of residence, who is in the House. He's on the Ag Committee. He's a squad member. You've got progressive ideas coming in. And if we can, I mean, it goes back again to, can we, you know, have elections that bring progressive people into the House and Senate? And until we can do that, it's really hard to imagine anything changing. But I'm seeing glimmers of hope. I'm seeing this new generation of people questioning these old orthodoxies. You know, people from places like Austin, in the case of Kassar, and New Jersey, in the case of Cory Booker, getting onto ag committees, being passionate about being on ag committees. And that does give me a lot of hope.
I'm with you there. I think it's gradual. It's going to take a while, and it's going to take a progressive Congress and a progressive president at the same time, but it's foreseeable.
I do think that the next Democratic president, whoever that is, will not be someone who thinks, oh, I should appoint someone like Tom Vilsack to the USDA. I think this is the last gasp of that kind of ideology, and we'll get someone more progressive in the USDA the next go around. That's my hope.
Yeah, I hope you're right. Thank you, Tom. I'm so glad we did this. Really terrific.
Yeah, thank you for being. I don't get to address audiences like you're, you know, like you've got this great foodie audience that, and you know, this is what you've always been. This has always been your role, is making this stuff real for the foodies and making people, the foodies, realize that, hey, if we want to have a really delicious food future, we've got to address these big issues.
Well, one tries. All right. Anyway, thanks, Tom. I'm glad you joined.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you to Tom Philpott for joining us today. You can follow him on X at Tom Philpott. That's TomPhilpott. And check out the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future at clf.jhsph.edu. Another thank you to Barrett Washburn, and get ready for more from him next week. Follow him on Instagram at BWASHBU. And thank you, of course, to Mark and to our engineer, Davis Lloyd. We're back next week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.